Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Greetings and welcome to Topically Yours on the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul. And as always, I'm your host, Deirdre Schuler. And today I'm going to be speaking with filmmaker Danielle Earle, who's a two-time award-winning producer, director, and writer of the critically acclaimed web series Brooklyn Is in Love. She's the owner of PL Entertainment LLC, which is based in New Jersey, and the company specializes in full-length features and documentary films. Ms. Earle is also a member of the Writers Guild of America East and was featured in magazines such as Curve Magazine, After Ellen, Time Out, She Wired, The Village Voice, and Spotlight New Jersey. She recently screened at the Women's International Salon Film Festival this summer. Another film, or one of her films, is called Lover's Game, which is set to be released this fall. Presently, she's in production with her next film, and that's going to be the film we're going to talk about today, and that's called Letters to Frankie is a true life story about two brothers, Frankie and Daniel Thompson, who originally went to play a joke on a friend, but it went terribly wrong, and the result was was killed. Frankie was 16 at the time, but tried as an adult, and his brother Daniel was 20. Without money to afford a good lawyer, Frankie and Daniel found themselves in prison without any opportunity to give details that were left out in their trial and that could have reduced their sentence. Well, we're going to talk to Danielle about her films and about the plight that many African-American and Hispanic youth find themselves in when dealing in the criminal justice system. So anyway, Danielle is here, and so why not welcome her to the show. How are you? And welcome, Danielle Earle.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and good afternoon. I really appreciate all your support with the film, and I'm really excited about this interview and you having me on your show. Thank you so much.
So you're quite welcome, and so well, let's talk about you for a bit. Tell me about where you're from and how you got interested in the entertainment business.
Thank you so much. My family, I was born in Boston, New York, actually, but I've been living in Oakland, New Jersey for most of my life after college. And in 2010, I started the production company, film production, called PL Entertainment LLC. And we basically just focus on feature films and documentary. I kind of started doing a documentary series called On the Scene, where I interviewed unsigned artists in the area in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, and kind of just following their stories and their struggles and how they kind of started, you know, with the music thing. Right after the On the Scene series, I started working on narrative. I took a class at City College in New York for directing, and that was before the LLC for PL Entertainment, and that kind of helped me, you know. I just kind of started to develop a love for film directing at that time, and I started a web series called Brooklyn Is in Love, And so I kind of started, you know, taking it really seriously, and especially just, you know, each season writing the episodes. And so after that, I started another film called Lover's Game, which is coming out very soon. And we've been working on that for about 2 years. And so right now we're working on a production for Letters to Frankie. So that's kind of how it goes.
Well, you might want to move around a little bit so you come in clearer.
Oh,
but,
sure.
Did you, I didn't hear quite if whether you went to school for filmmaking. Is that the case?
Yes. I went to school at the City College of New York, and I just started taking classes there for film directing. And that's kind of where it all started, and I started just, you know, being more serious about just, you know, film directing and going, developing storylines. And so while I was there, I did the series On the Scene, and then I just, after that, started working on Brooklyn Is in Love series. And yeah, kind of just since I, you know, kind of was going to school out there, I kind of started loving, you know, New York, you know, the scene and everything with the music, especially in Brooklyn, a lot of great artists out there. And so that's kind of how it all developed.
And tell me, you've done 3 films so far, or at least 2 are accomplished, and 1 you're working on now, which is The Letters to Frankie. Give me a little synopsis of each film.
Well, basically,
talk about Letters to Frankie last.
Well, the first series, the first project we worked on was Brooklyn Is in Love, and that's basically just about 3 friends living in Brooklyn. And the time that I wrote it, I was like my mid-20s, so now it's like 4 years later. And so during that time, especially with the Wall Street, a lot of the kids, you know, it was during the time that Obama got into office. And so a lot of the kids, especially in my age range, you know, they were struggling, they were trying to find work, and, you know, it was a really tough time, and there was protesting going on in Manhattan. And so I started writing a series about just, you know, living in Brooklyn, and the lead is Diane, and it basically follows her storyline on her and her boyfriend, Jeremy. And what ends up happening is she's on his way from work. He calls her, and he's actually going to come home to propose to her. And what ends up happening, he ends up getting attacked on his way to see her. And the person ends up shooting him, so he ends up dying. So that's like the first scene in the first episode, the first season. And so it kind of follows her her storyline, you know, right after Jeremy passed away. And so all her 2 friends, Nikki and Brian, both of them are just basically helping her through this. And but it definitely, it just kind of just shows their storylines too. Nikki's kind of like the wild child, you know, thing. She's, you know, always looking for different people, you know, different men. And, you know, but she realizes that, you know, she needs more than that. You know, she needs a commitment, or she needs, you know, to find love. And Brian, he plays the gay character in the series, but he's an actor. He's trying to make it. He's struggling. And so what ends up happening is, you know, especially with college, his father is unable to pay his tuition. So he ends up kind of like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to, you know, survive now. So I want to be an actor. And so his friend ends
Who are the actors we're still talking about Brooklyn Is in Love, right?
Yes. The lead actor is Miranda McCauley. She's also in Lovers, and she's starring in it. Also, Katha Sy plays Brian, and Katya Gert. She's actually she came in during season 2. So she's been with us, and she plays Nikki in the series. And so basically, it's kind of just, you know, those are the 3 main characters, the actors that I picked, and it kind of just follows the stories and the people, you know, around them, and that's kind of how it all started.
And what is the other film? The other film, you need to move around again because you're getting a little,
I'm sorry.
Lover's Game.
Who's
give me a brief synopsis of that one.
Oh, sure. Mother's Game, it stars Crawford Collins, Miranda McCauley from Brooklyn Is in Love, and also Blaine Pennington. He had a small part in Brooklyn Is in Love season one, and also he came back in season two, but it was just a small role, and he came in. And that storyline, it's basically, you know, it's a for LGBT feature film, but it's also, it's just about a woman that's an art gallery owner. And her husband is a district attorney in New York. So they have, you know, wealth, power, everything. And so she's going through a rough time right now. She's trying to have a baby. And she ends up finding out that she can't. And she goes to the doctor's office and he says, well, you know, I'm sorry to tell you, but, you know, you're unable to have, you know, children. And it kind of just crushes her heart. And especially with her husband, you know, he's kind of with the district attorney. He's like, I can't, you know, he feels kind of disconnected. He, you know, he's kind of this powerful person and he can't, you know, give her a child. And it just makes him very, so one day she ends up meeting a painter that's, you know, one time she's walking down the street and they end up becoming, you know, very close friends and, you know, the relationship gets closer. And so he suspects that she might be having an affair. So, but I don't want to you know, give away too much of the information, but
we'll end it at that because we want to move on to letters with Frankie because we're basically going to talk about that primarily. Yes. So, tell me about your latest film, the one you're working on now, Letters to Frankie.
Yes, Letters to Frankie was. It was actually a film that I, when I was at City College in New York, that was the film that I wanted to do for my thesis film, actually. And what ended up happening is it was originally supposed to be a documentary project. And so, you know, I started doing, you know, Brooklyn Is in Love, and I felt at this point, you know, it was a good time to promote that film. And it basically tells the story of a case that happened in Oakland, New Jersey. It's based on true events. About Frankie Thompson. I went to school with him. He was 16 years old when it happened, and it was with his brother, Daniel. One night, it's basically the same premise that you mentioned earlier, that they end up being a prank that really went wrong. So basically when it ended up happening, the next day they were sentenced. They arrested them, and they went through the trial, but what ended up happening is they got sentenced. Frankie was 16. He got sentenced for 25 years. His older brother, 35 years, and he was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, you know, a time that really, it really shook, you know, the town. It was, you know, a predominantly, you know, white neighborhood is right next to, you know, Franklin Lakes, you know, area. And a lot of people just since then, you know, totally kind of just, you know, read the storyline in the papers, newspapers, and they kind of, already it was like, oh, you know, these people are basically the brothers are kind of like criminals in a way. And it was not, and because I knew Frankie and his family personally, you know, it really bothered me, you know, especially during that time. And my mother
Are
actually,
you saying, you knew them, right? I mean, did you go to school with them?
Yes, I did. He was actually in my class, my English class. I grew up with them. He came into Oakland around the same time. I believe it was in middle school. So I knew him in middle school. I actually, after school, he knew my neighbor, and I actually hung out with him. So, you know, I knew him after school and the family in town. So, and he was just a nice, you know, bubbly person, and he was a straight-A student. He had zero record, you know. He's just a nice person, to you know, especially to the other people and teachers. He actually had an effect on the teacher who actually helped, who donated this to some, my teacher, my English teacher, because she had an effect on it too. You know, it's been on our mind for so long that, you know, I felt, you know, I wanted to kind of event that happened. But for the film, it's basically a different, you know, storyline. We changed the names, and so it kind of has a different twist to it. But it's just based on this event that happened. In the town.
In real life, but you fictionalized it to some point. Is that what you're saying, that you changed the names and characters but and fictionalized it somewhat, but it's basically the true life story of these two brothers?
Yes.
Tell me about, Well, what happened exactly? I mean, there was a they ended up committing the crime, correct? It wasn't that they didn't do it, but there was some extenuating circumstances. Is that the case?
Yes. Yes, I actually found out more information about the case, and what ended up happening was Daniel was he had organized. He wanted to go out there that night, but Frankie was, he's the youngest brother. He didn't know anything about it. He just followed his brother that night to go to the gas station. And so that's, basically that's the reason why, especially with the film, Frankie, he was a minor, 16. He kind of just followed after his brother and what he was doing, and he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I just felt that, and there were also developments that we found in the case, and I can't, discuss too much about it, but that a lot of things that went on that night, that could have actually lowered the sentence, and, he could have actually probably walked through, probably weren't based on the evidence that we found, because there are a lot of other things that happened, in that event. It wasn't just they were just going to go there and hurt someone and, and ended in someone,
Yeah. Yeah, you're basically saying that when they went there, it was definitely not premeditated and it wasn't with harm in mind. It just, things worked out very badly and that's what the result was, but it wasn't the intent.
Yeah.
But, who, tell me about their mother.
Right.
And what transpired with her?
Well, basically, when that event happened, she ended up, when she found out, the cops, the police, came to her house, she didn't know, about it, that night until they got home, so she ended up going to, the police department, she ended up going with them, the two boys, and basically she had to sign papers, she didn't know what she was signing, everything happened, she expressed to me, very fast, and they just already started to question them, and the two brothers, and they were immediately arrested, and and so the sad thing about it was she didn't have representation or anything at that time to be able to, especially to have a fair trial. Yeah, and
well, they didn't have a lawyer to advise them when they went to the police station.
No, she basically. I know I have to look more on the case. She might have had like a public defender, but she didn't have any money, especially for a good, lawyer representation to, especially with this type of case, so it's kind of, they didn't even actually, even during the trial, they weren't able to add any evidence that they wanted to bring up in court. It was basically just one-sided. I ended up finding out there wasn't a jury even for this case. It was just a judge. There were two judges that came in, for the trial. So, already immediately it was kind of like they didn't really have a chance, and it's like they, they wanted to have, people, there's a whole bunch of people that came during the trial that wanted to be on, on the stand and, to kind of represent Frankie and say that he was a great kid. The teacher came, he was dating, he had a girlfriend at that time that lived in the town. She came, students. And they wouldn't, represent him to kind of show that,
So they denied the references from people that were trying to say that they were good people and the court would not allow their testimony?
Wouldn't allow it.
I'm confused as to whether the paralegal is part of your movie or that happened in real life. What was the story there?
That I kind of developed, it wasn't, paralegal. I just, to kind of have the flow of the storyline of a paralegal that kind of, basically, reads this case and says, I really have to do something about it, and wants to kind of, help this person, especially the mother in need, and, wants to learn about the case and see if, there's any way, especially the two boys, if there's, to open up the case and for them to have a fair trial, so basically, I kind of developed that storyline. Originally, it was, in true life, it was my mother, and me, that her, learned about the case. She was writing him letters in prison, and she learned more about what actually happened that night. And that, you know, that kind of started a whole thing of me wanting to do a documentary, and I ended up getting a private investigator on the case that actually found, you know, a lot of evidence, you know, that a part of the case is a statement from someone that was there that kind of started my interest with, like, you know, getting the film out there, you know.
Yep. So tell me about, well, you mentioned when we talked earlier that sometimes in the certain states, and particularly New Jersey, the criminal justice system seems unjust, especially when it applies to minorities. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yes, especially in New Jersey, Bergen County. This is actually the second case where a minor was charged as an adult. The first case happened in the same town in Oakland, and it was actually it's in newspapers. Actually, know the person that you know was convicted, and or you actually nothing. You know, basically, you had to just pay the person. But it was a case of, I think it was like assault at the same Indian Hills High School, and it, you know, there's been a history of just, you know, profiling, you know, racial profiling, and even worse cases, you know, or just about, you know, the same, you know, as this case happening in Bergen County, you know, as a whole, you know, and a lot of people would talk about it, but, you know, not many people wanted to do something about it in a way, change, you know, and so people kind of just like, oh, you know, we know this type of behavior is going on, and a lot of times it doesn't make headlines, it doesn't make newspaper articles or anything. And I just felt that, you know, especially with this case that happened, you know, I really wanted to do something about it. And I thought the only way of doing it would be to make a film, you know, based on it. So just to kind of start a conversation and to, you know, for people to see that these events actually happen, you know, in these certain towns, you know, and it's not just a certain area, you know, that it happens in, you know. So, yep.
Well, it's happening across the country, and yeah. you're documenting it on film, but if you notice that lately there has been a lot of videos of people taking videos on their cell phone and elsewise of a lot of police brutality, which seems to be escalating throughout the country. So I think that it's an issue that is now coming into the public consciousness, I would say. Do you feel that if the boys had been able to afford a good lawyer, the evidence that was denied in court would have been allowed in?
I think so. Well, to me, I think if they had, you know, the funding, the resources, you know, they could have had, you know, like a lesser sentence, you know, pertaining to that. So, you know, in terms of money, you know, that, you know, is an, you know, a factor too. But, you know, I just felt that, especially with, you know, a harassment and things like that, that kind of pertained with this, you know, particular case, you know, I just felt that, you know, it could be money that's also part of it, but, you know, I felt it's a small, you know, undertone of, you know, social injustice, if you want to, you know, label, put that as the center of it, you know, as a big problem that I think pertaining to the case or the, you know, in the area.
Well, yeah. What charges exactly were levied against Frankie and Daniel? Were there several others or just one?
Well, they were charged with, it was a first-degree murder on 5 counts. They said that they, like, burglarized the location. They charged with, like, I believe it was for assault. And there was, they had like, a list of other attempts, or I think it was assault, manslaughter, a weapon, possession of a weapon, and just kind of a, like a list of different things. And to me, I felt that, you know, it wasn't them planning to, you know, kill this person that, you know, the event happened with, you know, with this person. They didn't come there to carry a weapon and they're going to, you know, hurt this person or kill this person, you know. I felt that, you know, they deserved, like,
so you're saying some of the charges might not have been necessary to levy against them?
That's what I feel, absolutely, especially for Frankie's case, You know, I felt that, you know, it wasn't his intention, you know, to follow his brother or to go out there that night to hurt anyone. Yeah.
And also, do you think that the newspaper sort of condemned them as murderers might have biased the trial in any way?
Your question, if you can repeat that.
I'm sorry, you have to move about a bit. You're getting
Story
I can't hear.
I'm sorry, if you can repeat that question again. Yes.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Oh,
repeat the question?
Just one more time.
I'm saying that the newspapers, do you think the newspapers, having condemned them as murderers, could have biased the case at all, the trial?
Oh, absolutely. Especially the other, you know, people that I, you know, talked to and that, you know, heard about, you know, the case or the film that I'm producing right now. Their version was basically just based on that article that came out, and immediately their you know, immediate reaction was that, you know, they were murderers. They came out there that night. You know, they attacked these, you know, that man that, you know, at the gas station, you know. And the sad thing is they don't know, you know, the whole story behind it, you know, and they don't know about these two, you know, kids that, you know, went out there that night. They didn't know them personally. That, you know, they didn't know their history. And I think that, you know, the sadness is that people kind of, you know, in their heads immediately say, okay, you know, without thinking about it or getting to know them, you know, immediately those guys are like murderers, you know, learning about more about them. I thought,
well, most people read the papers, and unfortunately,
right,
that's the way people read the papers, and whatever the paper says, right or wrong, people believe,
right,
their account.
Absolutely. And right. And I would just say that, you know, especially even, you know, TV, you know, when you go look at the news, there's not a lot of cases. There are cases that happen with other races, you know, like especially, you know, even in my town, we'll have it in a small print, you know, and you're like reading, you know, behind the paper of, you know, a case that happened. I was reading the other day, it was a white woman that was selling drugs in her house, and it was in Bergen County. And her fine was actually lower than another person with the same case in Bergen County. His bail was actually like twice as much, like $500,000 or something like that. And I'm like,
because they were a minority?
Yes, yeah. There was it was a black man and it was a white woman that lived in Bergen County, I think two towns away from me in New Jersey. And, you know, and it's sad because you see these two cases and you're like, well, you know, it's just the same thing, but it's because it's two different people, minority or a black man and a white woman. I guess, like, there's a difference there, but, you know, and it's, like, the same pattern with different cases that happen. And I just felt that, you know, especially the amount of minorities that are in prison, you know, and you never know that a lot of their stories, you know, they don't have a voice to be able to kind of express themselves and tell, you know, what really happened, their version of it.
Well, how many years has he been incarcerated now? How many years has it been since the case?
Since the case, for Frankie, since the trial, it's been about 12 years. 12 years he's been in prison.
Mm-hmm.
He was 16. The time that I did the interviews, he's in his early 20s, mid-20s.
Now, is your reason for doing the film to gain money or something to help them when they get out?
We actually have a fundraiser right now, Indiegogo campaign, to help raise funds for Francis's family. We want to donate some of the proceeds. It's going to go towards his family to get a good lawyer, to, you know, kind of, you know, research on the case and just, you know, even the money would be able to, as soon as he gets released, you know, he's going to have to start his whole life all over again, you know, and especially being in prison for that amount of, you know, years, it's going to be very drastic change when he comes out and he has to find a job and he has to get an apartment. And so we want to raise money, you know, to help him. And another thing I didn't add is when he was sentenced and he went to prison, the school didn't allow him to finish his degree, his high school diploma. So, you know, even with that, it's like he has to get an education also and, you know, have to just start all over again. So some of the proceeds are going towards his family and to the production of the film to help get it, you know, out there and to kind of spread more awareness about it.
And where did you say again that they can go to donate or Google? What did they Google again?
Oh, sure. If you go on Indiegogo.com and you just type in Letters to Frankie Fundraiser, you'll find us to donate. Also on our website, www.letterstofrankie.com, and you go on there and you'll see the link to go to our Indiegogo, and it can be any amount that you can contribute to help with the family during this time.
All right, well, let's tell me about your company, PL Entertainment. How did you start that? I mean, how old were you when you started that? Just out of college? Or
yeah. I was about what was it, 26 at the time, and so I was kind of doing it. I just kind of, you know, I took a leap of faith, and I started just writing for, you know, narrative. And I started filming. I did, you know, low-budget films, and I just kind of just kept moving, you know, after that. And just the first film that I ever did was at City College. I did Where the World May Lead Us. So I kind of, it was a short film, like 5 minutes. And I just liked how, you know, film production, you know, goes, and just working with a group of people and collaborating with them. So that's kind of how I just started the company.
Are you constantly fundraising? Because how do you fund your movies?
I do that. A lot of, you know, it's fundraising. You know, a lot of it right now, since I've been doing it for, you know, the amount of years, we have had investors. The one for Lover's Game, she actually made another film called Anatomy of a Love Scene. She did other films. She was working for 25 years. It's Jan Corin who helped donate to the film. She's also the associate producer for Lover's Game. And another person, Alan Greenstein, who's also the associate producer. So it kind of started growing. Like, first I was like, you know, right when I started doing it, it was all out of pocket in terms of fundraising.
And then started expensive.
I kind of just started, you know, but then, you know, after a couple of years, you know, a couple of people started kind of noticing it, Brooklyn Is in Love, and then we kind of started getting investors in it. And even with this film, we have people that are investing, you know, some of their funding for the film, and they're donating as well. So that's kind of how it's been, basically fundraising and doing that and getting more people involved in it.
Well, I wanted to say that I did a little research and I looked up that the so-called minority population, which includes Hispanics and all the people of color, the Hispanic population is actually 50.5 million population, and the African American is 41.2 million in the population, and the whites say that they're 77.7% of the population, yet the prison population is primarily African Americans right now, but they say that's about to be surpassed by Hispanics, who will now become the new majority of prisoners.
Right.
Given those percentages, what do you think can be done to address the inequity? Because obviously, if there's 77.7% of the white population, they obviously are committing crimes, but do you think that it's because of money that they're able to, the whites can buy themselves out of prison or prison, whereas those that don't have money are just automatically sent there?
Yeah, I absolutely think it does have to do, you know, with money. I believe it has to do with, like, status, you know, also in people that you know, and, you know, I definitely believe that. And it seems like they kind of, you know, as soon as you go to trial, they automatically, you know, vision that, you know, this person is the person that they read, you know, about, or they, you know, the transcripts say, you know, point them to be, you know, rather than, you know, having a fair trial, putting the evidence out there, you know, giving them a, you know, a chance to, you know, at least put that, you know, in the trial rather than just kind of throwing. I felt that it seems like it's like a one-sided kind of just throwing the book at them and just saying, okay, this prison's, you know, sentenced for, you know, like 10 years or, you know, more in prison without even knowing, you know, about anything, any other details. And especially what's going on, like you had mentioned, that people are videotaping cases like this happening. Now it's kind of starting to kind of get, you know, right in the, you know, to become a problem. Because, yeah, you know, and especially the case that happened, I believe, in Long Island, that a person was attacked, and you see that, and you're like, wow, you know, this stuff really happened. This stuff is, you know, I believe this stuff's been going on for many years, you know. It's just that
it seems to be escalating it more than ever, particularly the police brutality. It's all, I mean, they're knocking people down and shooting them, and women, the kicking. Dave, we had one video, they were kicking this woman who was on the ground. She was already on the ground, and she was pregnant, and they were still kicking her. I mean, some of the police brutality has gotten out of hand, and I don't know what the government, I don't know if the president is looking at these videos or what can be done to say, okay, we got to have a, we got to tether our own police department when they've got to the point. They're acting more like military soldiers than defenders of the law.
Yeah.
What I also want to ask you is, where will Letters to Frankie be featured? Where do you distribute your films? Is it in the mainstream movie theaters, or where would one see it?
Currently, we have a distribution, the Lover's Game Section 2. It's located in Manhattan. That's the company that's distributing it right now. For Letters to Frankie, we definitely want to send it for Sundance and try to, you know, first, you know, set up those avenues for film festivals, and that will help, you know, broaden the gap to, you know, be able to, you know, have it screened at, you know, movie theaters and, you know, expand on it, definitely. Basically for Lover's Game and the other films previous to this, we're gonna actually put it on VOD, so it's going to be on Vimeo, because right now everything is kind of ready on VOD, you know, especially with films. So we're going to, with Lover's Game, it's going to be on Netflix, Hulu, all those different media platforms with Section 2. So with Letters to Frankie, we're just kind of filming the film and putting it out there and just sending it to as many film festivals as we possibly can to kind of help spread more awareness on the film.
Okay, and I guess we're at the end of our show, so I'll just ask you one more thing, and that is, do you have any websites or can reach you and find out more about your projects?
Absolutely. For our company website, PO Entertainment, you can find us at www.poentertainment.com. And actually there you can find out links for all of the films that we worked on, and it also connects you to Lover's Game website. Letters to Frankie is also on there. You can actually find us even for the film, for Letters to Frankie, www.letterstofrankie.com. We also have a Facebook page, a YouTube page. You can watch videos. We're definitely going to be putting up updates and more videos on there for you guys to learn more about the film and our process in producing it.
Well, I certainly want to wish you luck with your project. And I thank you for coming on the show today to share your films and goals and to inform us also about the injustices of the justice system. So it's been a pleasure talking to you, Danielle.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me. It truly means a lot, especially for this this radio station to especially, you know, help with the Frankie family. And I really thank you from the bottom of my heart for having me on this program. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's been my pleasure to have you as my guest today. And this is the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. I'm your host, Deirdre Schuler. And as you heard, we've been talking to filmmaker, director, and writer Danielle Earle. And as always, I want to thank my listeners for making my topic yours.